Don't worry about it. He's sashibori-dana.
That's what I said. He's just sashibori-dana.
I suddenly had some spare time, so I decided we should do a podcast.
So we're doing it.
And by spare time, I mean, like, I'm taking a week off from shelf life. They gave me Christmas off this year because no one would be around to edit. And then we're going to Japan. We're going to Comic-Con.
Yeah, Winter Comic-Con.
So I have a week off for that.
Very happy about that.
So it means I'm not slavishly watching anime. They let me out of the basement.
Well, no, actually, we are still slavishly watching anime.
You're right. I'm trying to get ahead.
We're trying to get ahead.
Yeah. We've been watching pretty good stuff lately.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Luckily.
We really like Oedo Rocket. It's a good time.
Excellent.
And we've been watching, today we're watching the third.
Zasado.
Girl with the Blue Eye or whatever the hell.
Yeah.
It's pretty good, except for the horrible narrator. Especially in the first.
Worse than the Blade Runner narration.
Yeah, it's like
much,
really,
much, much
really,
worse.
Really bad.
Much worse.
Otherwise, good sci-fi times.
Yeah.
Ladies and gents.
Effective.
Right, but one reason I wanted to record was because it happened that I have a couple of recordings related to Scott Pilgrim that I want to include in this podcast. And Scott Pilgrim's only marginally related to anime and manga, but I don't know. I think there's a lot to be said about how it relates, but there are two things I'm going to splice into the show. One thing is, in 2007, we went to the Museum of Comic and Cartoon Art Comic Festival, and I interviewed Brian Lee O'Malley for like 3 minutes or less about the comic. I did not think of very good questions in advance, and then I lost that recording and then found it again. So we're going to include that.
We're here at the Mocha Festival 2007. It's an independent comics festival in New York City in the Puck Building. It's probably way too noisy to hear this recording. But we're going to go and talk to Brian Lee O'Malley, who is the author of the Scott Pilgrim comics that we like so much, for no real reason, just because he posted it on his live journal. If anyone wants to interview me, you can. And so I took him up on that offer. So we are heading over there just now. We only have a 5-minute interview, if he's in his table. Let's find out. But yeah, we were tired to come up with only one question. It was going to be a video game question, but we don't play a lot of video games. So we're going to go with... But it's all about video games and the book and stuff.
Oh, yeah, but it's about old video games.
That's true.
Oh, yeah, yes. I still play those. I still
play old games.
I play NetHack.
I play, like, 2 new games per year. Like, not a lot.
So...
And I kind of suck nothing.
Second survey question is, has fame changed you?
Yes.
Do you feel famous now, or...?
A little bit. I don't know. Sometimes. In the right setting. Like, at a place like this. If I had my new book, I would feel so famous. But not really. Not so much today. So.
Then last year, like, sold out, like, different volumes of it or whatever?
Last year, I bought, like, 100 copies of Volume 3, which was, like, 2 weeks old or something at that point. And I sold them, like, in 2 hours or something.
Yeah, it was kind of...
So it was really crazy. So that was nice. But,
yeah.
You know, I don't think it's really changed me for real yet. Except I have some money, so I can, like, go to a hotel and sleep on someone's floor. So that's kind of nice.
That's the main difference.
So far, it's all good. You know, I think I'll get really mean and horrible in the future.
Not a rock star yet.
It's inevitable.
So, what did you think about that Comics Journal article?
Okay, for real, you guys were the first people who ever... I didn't know about it.
Oh.
I was like...
Oh my god, what are they gonna do?
So I was freaking out like the whole day after I got your email.
Did you read it then?
No. A lot of people told me about it, and I knew the guy who was writing it, like, I had heard that it was gonna happen, so I was like, oh no, it happened. Now I have to kill myself. But you know, I got over it. It took me about 24 hours.
But you didn't actually read the article.
No, I haven't seen a copy of it, so I've just been really busy, and I live, like, way out in the city, so it's hard for me to get stuff.
Yeah.
People gave me, like, a synopsis and stuff, so it doesn't sound that bad.
Well, it's just that it's embarrassing to read it. It's embarrassing for him because he so clearly doesn't, like, he doesn't get it.
I think it made the reviewer seem really old. I don't know. I think, like, it's really cruel to say. Like, I mean, I'm not some teenager either, but I was like, wow, he's really showing, like, this generation gap and not getting it. But
yeah.
It wasn't that bad. Anyway, just about it.
No comment.
We're confused, like, what does Hope do on the books?
On my books?
Yeah.
Everything.
What is her connection?
I don't have a copy here. She helps me when I'm, like, really at the end of my rope, I guess. So she's done, like, some, you know, background inking and that kind of thing. But for the most part, we don't really work together. Like, we work side by side, but we don't really collaborate all that much.
Okay, that pretty much clears everything up.
Alright, done.
And the director of the film, what's his name? Edgar...
Dunno.
Edgar...
I don't know.
Oh, man.
It's the guy who directed Shaun of the Dead.
Right. He gave a talk at NYU, and I recorded a little bit of his discussion on my new iPhone, which is actually Ed's old iPhone, which I finally got working. But so we'll put that into the show when it's all, like, leveled. He had a lot of really interesting things to say about the film. But we're going to talk about our views on the film and the comics, which I don't think were received as well as they should have been.
Well, the movie, certainly not.
Right. But the comics, they're selling okay.
Yeah, the movie was a total bust. The movie, if I were a producer, I would have put all my chips on that film, and I would have lost all my money because I was so certain that it was going to become a blockbuster hit.
Before you saw it or after
but
you saw
instead,
it?
But instead, after we saw it.
Okay.
Yeah. But even before, I thought that this is exactly the sort of thing that people would want to see. I thought that there was actually an enormous market for this. Whenever I think that, I'm wrong, and this time was no exception, which is why I'm not a producer.
I think we should explain, like, the sort of premise behind the film. I mean, the premise behind the comic and the whole thing and what makes it good.
All right, go for it.
Okay.
Although I presume everyone listening to this already knows
maybe
what
not
it's
everyone.
About, but go on.
Okay, in case you've been living in a box, never heard of it. So Scott Pilgrim is a guy who's, like, 25?
He's 23.
He's 23. He's 23. He lives in Canada, and he's kind of a slacker living in with his gay roommate in a crappy apartment where he doesn't really own anything. He doesn't have a job, but he's in a band called Sex Bob-omb, and he dates a lot of girls or has dated some girls in the past.
That's true.
And at the opening of the story, he is dating a high school student, which his friends do not approve of, and he hasn't, like, done anything untowards to her yet. Then suddenly, in the part different parts of the story, reality kind of breaks into old school video game logic. Like, fights break out as Scott is forced to duel each of his new love interest. He meets another girl.
You blew it, man.
I know, right?
You blew it. You totally blew it.
Where the story intersects with video game logic and this sort of romance of early 20-something people. That's, like, the good part. Enemies explode into coins, etc.
True.
And it appealed to me a lot because it just seems, like, so seamless in the world, how the reality of Scott having an extra life or a power meter of some sort, it's worked into the narrative in such a way that seems extremely natural. And the movie really did a good job of adapting that, where everything kind of unfolds as if it has this kind of logic as well. They didn't really go for the 8-bit kind of thing, but the comic is drawn in a much more simplistic style.
I think it functions well because we humans interpret our lives through different narrative frames. And what I mean by this, I guess, is that in the culture in which you are raised, it gives you certain ideas of causality and makes you understand things in a certain fashion.
The
right?
Fancy pants way of explaining it. Is that what you explain people's strengths in terms of second edition D&D stats?
Well, right. So I'm getting to that.
Okay.
Which is that if you, for instance, in the Middle Ages, everything was framed in biblical terms and everything was allegorical. You know, you might say this is from that excerpt from The Day the Universe Changed, you may recall, with what's his dink? What's the guy's name? Burke?
James Burke.
Where he mentions that the way people understood the world was in biblical terms. So if flowers were red, they were red because it was a representation of the blood of Christ. If a tree had three branches, it was because of the Trinity, and so on. So in more modern terms, we nerds of the world, our backgrounds are heavily steeped in games. For me, it happens to be role-playing games. And role-playing games themselves are a recreation of reality. That is, the physics of your reality are written into the rules of the game. The rules are meant to create a representation of reality.
Mm.
So you read the rules to play the game. The game is a representation of reality, and because one becomes so steeped in the game, you bring the terminology and that frame of reference to you in real life.
Mm.
So, well, I was trying to come up with an example.
Oh, like in the movie that Scott has the P-meter.
Right, right. Well, before getting into the film, so let's say I'm eating a banana, right?
Sure.
And the banana breaks in half and starts to fall. And when I snatch it out of the air, I go, I made that Dex roll.
No, it actually says things like this.
I certainly do.
It's not just an example.
Right. Or when you go, you're called into the boss's office to explain yourself, and you're really intimidated, but you're able to suck it up.
Yeah.
And that means you made your save versus fear. I made my save versus fear.
Right.
So the way in which we understand things, and the way in which we sort of recite them back to ourselves in a way that's meaningful is based a lot on the culture around us. So that is made very clear and concrete in Scott Pilgrim, where the rules of 8-bit video games kind of inform Scott's life, which on the one hand is representative of his slacker nature, his sort of inability to get out of this retro phase, that retro phase being his, you know, childhood.
Yeah.
And this is something that is more and more in the news, and probably all of the listeners of this podcast probably identify to a certain extent, except for maybe our parents.
Right.
That you have this
The culture of
phenomenon now of, yeah, people
who...
I think
New York Magazine called them grups.
Right.
Where it's like you're in your 20s, but you're not necessarily married yet, you don't have any kids, your career hasn't necessarily taken off, or maybe it's starting to, but with lack of other... You don't have a mortgage yet or a divorce, and so you're sort of just free to go through life and re-examine the fun parts of your childhood by
buying
all the games.
Instead of growing up and putting your childish things away, you continue to play with them,
more toys.
What we have done,
and better toys. Yeah.
And I'm kind of resentful that it's become a cultural phenomenon, because I'd like to think of myself as unique.
Yeah, I want to think of myself as an outsider.
But
never true.
I think that there were certainly people for whom this was true, but they were, you know, going back to at least the beginning of the 20th century, or maybe at least post-war, because when you have an agricultural society, there's not much room for leisure.
Well, I think it's like partly starting from the 70s and widespread use of birth control.
The sexual revolution has
After that, like, I think in my parents' generation, there was a lot of pressure to get married very quickly after college, or if you weren't going to go to college, get married. And now people delay marriage until such time as there are some studies recently where people delay marriage until their careers are in more of a stable place.
Right. And we represent
college
that,
educated people.
And people are putting off childbearing later and later and later.
Yeah.
And we are representative of that.
Yep.
my point was only that people who have sort of failed and gotten stuck in their childhood frame of reference, way of thinking, they've probably always existed, but it takes a very rich, like, monetarily wealthy society to create the circumstances under which you could continue to live your childhood life even after entering the working world.
Or teenage life.
Teenage life.
Yeah, but like being in a band or playing a lot of video games after work.
Yep.
Like, why would you not?
Which is pretty much everyone we know fits into this category, or everyone we would want to know, really. So that... It's very well described, or it's very well displayed in Scott Pilgrim, in both the movie and the comic book.
Yeah, I think there's also an urban life kind of aspect of it. And there are more and more people, like young people, who move to large cities for all of the advantages that brings, and then lead a kind of life of not necessarily owning a car and hanging out in the city, living with a bunch of roommates. And I think the roommate thing comes through a lot less in the film than it does in the comic but it's just kind of, but I think that's the kind of set of people that ends up getting labeled hipsters, whether you might fall into that category or not. It's just like, you're young and you live in an urban area and are probably white.
Right. And I don't remember who it was you were telling me about, who, maybe it was on NPR,
yeah,
where the criticism of hipsterdom was its lack of artistic participation.
Oh, it was lack of political participation.
Ah, right, political participation.
Because the reason why this one guy commented that nobody wanted to be called a hipster, because being a hipster it's not a respectable subculture, that because it has no legitimacy to it, like as the way we currently use it. And the term is borrowed from an older subculture that had a political thing behind it and more of a cultural legitimacy. But everyone who you ask, like, only recently had the author of this essay come across people who were like self-identifying as hipsters. That's really recent. Like, mm-hmm. For the most part, people are like, oh, I'm not a hipster. I'm, I don't know, a member of the Green Party, or, oh, I'm not a hipster. I'm, you know, a locavore, or, oh, I'm not a hipster. And they'll like identify with some other subculture. And I do that too. I was saying like, oh, I'm not a hipster. I'm a nerd or a geek or a dork or something, because that has some kind of legitimacy. There's like a legitimate dork culture, which I strongly identify with and participate in, that has like a weight to it and a history.
Mm.
But if I say I'm a hipster, I'm just saying like, oh, I'm just this random person with skinny jeans who's white and lives in a city.
And while I understand fashion not at all, so can't really comment on how that affects the subculture, what I can say is that in my experience, hipsters generally have a disdain for earnestness and anything that is, you know, meaningful or worthwhile. So where beatniks, I think, were frequently portrayed as being snobby, they were very aloof.
Yeah.
Because these are the people who sit in cafes in France and drink espresso
yeah. And read poetry.
They're right. And their finely tuned artistic sensibilities
yeah.
are so far above the rough base sort of, you know, proletarian sensibility that they have a deep disdain for everything that is accessible. Mm-hmm. I don't find that in the hipsters of today. What I find is a sort of a reaction to a lot of the activism, a lot of the political activism, where people or hipsters are sort of fed up with the identity of protesting and, you know, bandying about these political causes
mm.
when in fact there's actually not much of a political contribution being made. Someone close to us who I would consider in many ways a hipster, he's very vocal about how he doesn't vote.
Yeah.
He doesn't vote because his vote doesn't count. He encourages other people not to vote because voting is stupid. You have no chance of making any kind of impact on the system. So it doesn't matter. Don't bother. That's a very hipster sensibility.
I think the label has grown so wide at this point, though, that it's difficult to make that kind of assertion for all hipsters.
Well, I'm not going to make it for all hipsters, but I will say I know a hipster when I see one. And
everyone says that.
I recognize that. Well, this is our show, man, and I can assert whatever I want.
Yeah.
And I associate that attitude with the label.
Mm.
And it does come through in Scott Pilgrim in a way where all of these young people are not politically active.
Mm.
They're artistic really only in as much as, you know, they are in a band that they're not even really sure, I don't think, why they're in it. They're in it to perform because it's fun and it makes them cool.
In the movie, they seem much more driven to get a contract.
In the movie, yes. They seem as though they care much more about the commercial aspects of it. The culture is so steeped in irony that these are people who are unstuck in values. It's like they are unanchored. Mm. They have it's sort of an adoption of moral relativism where they just sort of shrug their shoulders at everything. And so it's wonderful to see that Scott Pilgrim, the character and the series, grow and change and discover that that is not the way to be happy and healthy and human.
Mm.
It's something that I think more contemporary art should deal with, because there's lots and lots of stuff about the, you know, modern alienation, how technology is alienating, but there's very little sort of prescriptive texts about what to do about that.
Yeah.
Scott Pilgrim is a prescriptive text. It shows you how in a relationship you have to compromise and help the person you're with overcome all of the obstacles that have been put in place by all of their previous relationships.
Right.
I think, something that's very important.
Right. So the core of the plot, Scott has to fight all of his love interest, Ramona's evil ex-boyfriends, and who arrive, who all arrive like one after another and challenge him in video game type fights. But there's an important message at the core of the film, at the core of the story, that's just like, when you date someone, you have to date all of their baggage as well. And you have to work through it with them. And it's not, always fun to meet someone new, but it's work to be in a relationship, that you, neither person can just kind of like coast forward emotionally, that there's a lot of things you have to face.
Right. What's the quote from Roseanne that you say sometimes?
What?
The quote about first you have to deal with what their mother did to them.
Oh, she's like peeling an onion or an apple or something. She's like, first you have to deal with what their mother did to them, and then you have to deal with like what the ex, you know, their ex did to them, and then another ex. I don't know what all the layers were.
Well, the idea being, you know, you deal with all of that,
right?
And then at the center, that's the good stuff, you know.
Take it in the middle.
And it's really true. It's shocking to me. For a very long time, I didn't understand what the deal was with 4chan, and so now I read it fairly consistently, and I am shocked to discover how few people, or rather how many people, haven't the foggiest idea, it seems, how to relate to the opposite sex.
Oh. Like, they don't even approach them as human? They're just like...
There's no sense of humanity. They seem to want to apply rules, like rules to a relationship or rules to courtship or what have you.
Yeah.
That kind of completely ignores the fact that they're dealing with another human who's inconsistent and...
not perfect.
You know, has, right, imperfect problems, and, you know, so many questions of, you know, why do girls act this way or whatever? You know, why do guys always act this way? When in fact...
they should just be like, why do people act this way in a relationship?
Why does the person that I'm with...
act that way?
You know, why can't I treat this person as an individual? And it's like it never comes up.
It never
occurs. It's always discussed in generalizations.
Yeah.
That are so grand and specious. And I understand, you know, a lot of these people are quite young, but not all of them. And there's no sympathy or understanding that what you're dealing with is
another human,
a living, breathing, you know, thinking individual with experiences and so forth.
One thing I really like about the story that comes through maybe a little bit more in the comic, you get more of like Ramona's side of this, but in the movie you get more of Scott's side of it, where when they start off their relationship, they realize like they each realize the other person is so much trouble and that their relationship is trouble. What? Here, use this. Sorry, Noah just drank a bunch of root beer and then it foamed out of his mouth. In humorous fashion, staining his Ranma one-half t-shirt.
Gross. That was horrible.
But
sorry, I was trying to drink upside down. Doesn't work very well.
You still haven't learned anything. You're soaking some of that up there. So, their relationship is so much trouble. Like, because Scott, in the movie in particular, Scott is being attacked by all these people, you know, physically, And at one point, he starts to get really angry after, like, one fight after fight. Like, is Ramona really worth it? Is it worth all the trouble to have to fight 7 people? And, like, they just seem to bicker a lot. And there's this moment of, like, is it worth it? Like, maybe he should just walk away from it. And they kind of, like, have this mini breakup thing that happens in the comic, too, where... But in the comic, Ramona is discovered to be a runner. And she has continually run away from her problems in each of her previous relationships. And so then you start to get this foreboding, like, oh, she's going to run. She's going to run from Scott, too. Yeah. And you don't really want her to. Ramona is a lot better built in the comics, but the comics are longer. And for those of you who don't know, don't follow this kind of entertainment news, the movie was written when only one or two of the comics had come out, and Brian Lee O'Malley hadn't finished writing the 6-volume series yet. So the comic and the movie have very different endings from each other. And the movie, they originally shot one ending and then knew it was, or they started to shoot one ending and realized it couldn't work. So they made up another ending. And then Brian Lee O'Malley, at one point, he was writing towards a different ending in his head as well, and then made up a new one before it finished. So there's these different timelines of, like, how it could have ended, which is why the end of the movie is a little bit of a mess.
Yeah, the end of the film is not good. It is quite problematic, and I don't think that the spoiler statute of limitations has run out on the Scott Pilgrim film, which is a shame, because I'd really like to talk in depth.
I think they closed the window on the distribution, so, like, I think the Blu-ray is coming out, like, relatively soon.
Right.
So, like, we watched the Blu-ray at the screening that they did. Like, it had...
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, like, it was pretty much almost ready for market. So I think you can get it really soon. It was a really nice digital projection thing. Anyway. Oh, so, and when Brian Lee O'Malley got the idea for the comic, when he found out that he married another comic book artist whose name I can't remember.
Hope Larson.
I was thinking Chloe for some reason. So he found out that Hope Larson, that 3 of her ex-boyfriends were named Matt, and he kind of had this image, because you always want to picture, like, your partner's exes as, like, bad people, as evil people, or, like, not good characters, and that's why it didn't work out, or whatever. Like, they're kind of, I don't know, I think of that way, too.
Yeah, I disagree, but...
I'm sure your ex is really nice, but she was, like, really great or whatever, like, I don't want to have that image in my head either. I want to think, like, it didn't work out because of some tragic flaw, and not because, you know, of something else.
Right, well,
not because you're flawed, and not because I honed in on your territory and stole you, or something like that.
I don't feel that way, but very clearly the vast majority of the population does.
Right. So Brian Lee O'Malley wanted to picture this League of Evil Mats, and then he thought of that for the entire comic. But with the running, and so one thing that didn't come through to me when I first started reading the comic book series was that Scott Pilgrim is not a great guy. Like, when I first started reading it, I'm like, oh, he's kind of clueless, but whatever. He seems pretty average. He doesn't seem like a jerk. And I think in the movie, he's a lot bigger of a jerk. Like, his interactions with his high school girlfriend's name is Knives Chow. And she, like, it's heartbreaking to watch her in the film. Like, she really gets the short end of the deal. And in the comic, too, but in the movie, it comes off much worse, where you just feel so sorry for her, because you know it's not going to work.
Right. The actress was very, very good in the film, who played Knives. Knives gets a more full treatment in the comic, and something that was not adapted, unfortunately, because it was something that I really enjoyed. When Scott dumps her, which of course he doesn't want to do, and puts off until the very, very, very last moment when
he
absolutely has to, because everyone has been twisting his arm since he's going to start, you know, dating Ramona. And so...
Well, they both show up to the same show.
You watch Knives as she becomes an evil ex.
Yeah.
And she goes through the transformation, and she actually does. She dyes her hair, she changes the way she dresses, and she fights Ramona in a giant battle in the local mall, which is also not in the film, which is a damn shame.
You haven't written the book
yet. One of the best... That's from the first book.
Is it?
Yes, it is.
Oh.
It's very definitely from the first book.
I haven't reread the books in a while.
And I was disappointed that wasn't in there, because it was a really good fight. And that's when, in the comic, you suddenly realize that normal rules don't apply.
Yeah.
That the physics aren't, you know, they're game physics. They're not real life physics.
Right.
Because it's crazy kung fu action and, you know,
right,
with things being destroyed and so on.
Right. And people not getting horribly injured when they probably ought to.
Right.
That sort of thing. It was interesting to hear the director talk about the way they handled that in the film, which I wouldn't have noticed if he hadn't talked about it ahead of time, that he wanted to, he very carefully handled the way all of the characters deal with the first fight, because when the first ex-boyfriend shows up to fight, he shows up during a band performance, and I mean during a...
Yeah, it's a battle of the bands.
Right, during a battle of the bands. So like everyone, all of Scott's friends are there watching the bands play, and then all the action has to stop in the concert for their fight to transpire. And so what he said that he had everyone do is, like, he was careful to not have any of the characters react directly to anything that's happening in the fight. So no one ever is like, holy crap, that just happened. Like, they react to more like things like, at one point the guy in the film starts singing, and Scott's sister is like, what? He just started singing? Like, she reacts to that. She doesn't react to the fact that they're fighting. So right. Everyone kind of acts like this happens all the time. Like, crazy video game fights just transpire, and there's no reason to react.
And many of the characters are irritated that Scott Pilgrim is the hero. I mean, there's no way around it. He is the hero. The story's about him.
Yeah.
And this really gets on their nerves because, yes, he's the hero, which means he's the center of everyone's attention, which means, like, what are we? We're like window dressing. And it comes through very well in both texts.
I really liked the roommate in the movie.
Yeah, Wallace was very well cast.
Wayne Wallace. Right, he's like Macaulay Culkin's brother or something, and he is so hilarious in the film.
He nailed it. He nailed the role.
I mean, he was...
Not an easy role. I thought that they were going to screw up with that because I couldn't imagine anyone playing it very well.
No,
he did a great job.
He was very snarky and really funny. But a lot of people complain about Michael Cera?
Yeah, Michael Cera.
A lot of people didn't like him being cast as Scott Pilgrim because they think they were Michael Cera'd out.
Yeah, I was among them. Well, I didn't feel as though I was Michael Cera'd out.
But you hadn't seen like all the films between Superbad and this movie.
But
except for Juno.
Right. I still don't think that he was well cast in that role. Mm. I think that Michael Cera as an actor has a vulnerability to him that is not right for Scott.
Oh, I thought it was, because I think you need to be, he needs to be sympathetic.
Like, well, he has to be sympathetic, but not at first. Not very much at first. Because Scott is, he's pretty vacuous, you know?
Yeah. I think he could have stood and played by someone slightly more attractive than Michael Cera. Because, like, why do girls keep going out with this guy? I assumed it was just because he was cute and in a band or something.
Well, I don't know. I can't really speak to that. He's a fun person.
Yeah.
Right? He has very few cares in the world. It's not like he's a drag or anything.
True.
I don't know. He's clearly not a ladies' man.
And yet. But
well,
yeah,
he didn't have a reputation for being a ladies' man. He totally ham-handedly hit on Ramona.
Yeah, he did a very good job.
Yeah. That's also important because you really have a feeling of what he stands to lose if he loses Ramona. It's true that, yes, she is his girl of destiny, but this is not something that he can really recover from. I mean, there's a reason why he was dating a naive high school girl, I think.
So she couldn't break his heart?
Well, yeah, because this was not anything that he took very seriously.
Right. There was no risk. Or he felt like there was no risk.
And over the course of the story, he really does learn to the extent that it is very serious. And
right.
You...
There's no such thing as, like, a relationship where, like, no one will get hurt.
Right. Well, that's just like that movie that you hate, Terms of Endearment, right? Yeah, I know you hate it so much. But that's the same. It's the same moral that you have to be willing to put yourself out there. And how does it's really a great kind of very impactful poem. It's, if you shut out love, you will be shut out by love and lay screaming on her doorstep for eternity. It's something like that, you know, howling in the darkness for eternity. And maybe that's a very emo way to put it, but I certainly think that it's true. You know, I certainly think that human relations are, you know, the most important thing.
Yeah. They just reminded me of some other quote about love by someone like Matt Groening or someone like that, where it's just like, love is like being run over by a sled in the Arctic and trapped under the ice or something, and then like at night the ice weasels come.
Yeah, and then the ice weasels come. Yeah, I've never really had that experience.
Well, because there's the flip side which weirdly was in like some web comic I read that it's portrayed really really well that when you really open up your heart to someone and you let them in, once they're in there, they can do a lot of damage on the way out.
It's true.
And so Scott is coming off of like a really bad breakup, which, the window's open, there's like a motorcycle. But Scott is coming off a really bad breakup from his previous relationship, which doesn't come to light for a little while in either text. And that's kind of why he's dating a high schooler, because he thinks he will not get hurt in this relationship. And the breakup was so bad in the comic, the way he describes it is that there are several months of his life where he can't remember anything that happened. And the next thing he knew, it was months later, and he got a job at a burrito restaurant.
Yeah, he was working at a burrito restaurant.
He was working at a burrito restaurant.
Like, he comes to, and he's standing there in the burrito restaurant at the kitchen counter.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, serving people.
Right.
Another scene that was not included in the movie.
Right, which I really, because really,
really enjoyed.
He said he used to eat at the burrito restaurant every day, and it was, like, the best burrito in the world, and he made a song about it, and he, like, sings the song. But, so I think it's covered well, how they cover that period of time in the film is his roommate is very carefully to protect, like when they mention his ex-girlfriend's name, he's like, we don't say the E word in this house. And you get the feeling like William Wallace looked out for him when there were months where Scott was too depressed to do anything and probably just laid on the floor of William's apartment doing nothing.
But at the same time, Scott Pilgrim is someone who has done a lot of damage on his way out.
Right. And not necessarily realized it until he got
hurt. The member of his band, Kim Pine, who is really a tragic figure because it becomes apparent relatively early on. I mean, she's very bitter. She's, you know, she's angry and just a ball of tension. It's because she's still in love with him and she hasn't been able to get over it and get on with her life either.
And now they're in this band together.
And now they're in a band together, which is like...
It makes her kind of angry.
The worst thing. Yeah. And...
She's so cute, though.
There's... It goes... Yes, she's very cute. And there's the t-shirt that I don't think is like Brian Lee O'Malley approved. I think that it was spontaneously created by the internet.
Yeah.
Where it's like, Kim Pine is my girlfriend.
Oh.
That's really... She gets, it comes off much worse in the comic. She gets it's really raw. Mm. There's a point where, like, the three of them are at a party and they're drunk, and this is Scott, Ramona, and Kim. And Scott and Ramona are, like, intimating that they could have some kind of a three-way thing, and Kim is in love with Scott.
Ugh.
Like, how painful is that? How horrible is that?
Yeah.
That's, like, one of the worst things I can imagine.
Oh.
And she does, in the final volume, really get her due, and she is able to recover, just like Knives is able to recover, because people are resilient, and it's a good thing.
I think it's also a good message to have in the text for young people in love. Like, yes, you may get hurt horribly, but you can get over it, or you may have been hurt horribly.
It will be a terrible time for you. You will grieve, and you may lose months and months of your life and then wake up in a burrito restaurant.
You know? At least he had a job at that point.
Yeah, at least he was employed.
Yeah.
He didn't spend it totally wastefully.
Right.
But for our demographic, for the dork demographic, I guess, the relationships were treated in a way that I found more authentic and meaningful than pretty much anywhere else.
Yeah, because you don't really get that. You never get that kind of story in romantic comedies, and then there are like just horrible kind of breakup movies, like what I assume that the Julia Roberts one that was based on a book that came out, where she takes a year off from work and eats her way through India.
Eat
food.
Eat, pray, love. Very good.
Right.
By which I mean very bad.
Yeah. Because those are about like older people who aren't like young 20-something people in love. And I think that also in the Scott Pilgrim world, how it's all of these people who are, you know, post-college, hanging out together, dating each other, and it's a group of friends, you know? Like, it's an ensemble cast kind of thing going on in the comic and the movie that you don't usually see in regular kind of movies. Like, I think the TV show Friends tried to get into that kind of demographic life going on, but it just doesn't... It never seemed realistic in a way that I could latch onto, even after I moved to a city and lived in a New York City apartment.
Right.
And it felt like my life was in second gear. I think the premise of the show approached that, but the execution, not so much.
I guess so. Well, it's in writing, I think, it is very difficult to write relationships with that have had a duration, which is to say, you know, this is the first time that we see these two characters, and we need to get from them a certain kind of exposition, you know. But it has to be written in such a way that demonstrates that these two people know each other really well, and we need to understand that without having it, you know, in the text itself. Man, I can't believe that I've known you for 8 years. You know, that doesn't cut it.
Expositionary dialogue.
In,
bad news.
In the movie Hackers,
yeah,
which I actually still I like a lot, even though
you're
I
crazy.
Recognize, yeah, that it's a very, it's terrible. You know, it's not a very good movie at all. But at one point, a character has to hide something so that another character will find it. And he has a second to leave a message on her voicemail so that she knows where it is and no one else does. And he says, I put it where I put that one thing that one time. And she knows exactly where to go to get it.
Right.
That's really good. That's very effective. It gets across the relationship that those two characters have.
I'm like, not convinced, but sure.
I don't know. I find it very convincing myself.
I know what you're trying to get at, but I think any group of friends has that kind of, or any close friends have that kind of relationship. But if,
right,
like,
exactly.
The whole point is only to show these are close friends.
Well, no, the whole point is not to show that they're close friends. It's to show the way in which they're close friends.
Mm-hmm.
It's to communicate the depth and the color of the relationship and what kind of power dynamic exists and, you know, what kind of shenanigans that they've pulled together and so forth. Because it can't, if you do it generically, it's going to come across as cliche. And in anime, just like you always have, like the childhood friend is just a stereotype.
Yeah,
right?
It's just a type.
It's just a type. And that works for them, and it doesn't bother them. Mm. The Japanese audience, that is.
Yeah.
Drives me nuts.
Yeah.
Makes me insane.
Because I want to know, like, what kind of childhood
friends. Because it's not, I don't go for the otaku database. I want to know why these characters are unique and interesting. And as you know, Nietzsche puts it, deep, dangerous, and interesting. Those are the things that the human soul possesses. That's what makes us human and why it's difficult to be human. It's because we're deep, dangerous, and interesting. And that's both the best and the worst of being human.
Mm.
Stories that really bring that out are the best kind.
So, the film didn't do well at the box office. Resounding non-success.
Made about 20% of what it cost in its U.S. release.
And I've heard a lot of theorization about why it didn't do so well. And I think the most reliable discussion we've heard of this was by our friends who work in the film industry. And they were really criticizing how the posters were just not selling the film. Like,
yeah.
They only had Michael Cera on them. One friend of mine said, like, if they had Ramona Flowers on the poster, like, the trouble is she's not a known star, so she's not really selling the film. But she looks cool, and I think my friend thought, like, a lot more young women would probably see the movie. I think it was really damning in the Union Square subway stop, someone had scrawled in Sharpie across a poster for the film, like, oh yes, nothing's hotter than a geeky white dude.
Yeah.
And I'm like, ooh, that's...
Burn.
That's probably someone in the demographic who should be watching the movie.
I agree that the posters were bad, but I don't accept that explanation. Because for my money, given how large the gaming industry is, and for the pitch to be, you know, a guy has to defeat his girlfriend's seven evil exes in video game format.
Right.
That's a really strong pitch. This is something that I believe people would really want to see.
Yeah.
Because this is the way that we internally sometimes digest our lives.
Mm.
I thought it was a really strong concept. And
you don't really get that from the poster. I don't know. The early trailers for the film, I was really worried about.
Maybe you don't necessarily need it if you have enough positive word of mouth.
True. Which there
and
wasn't.
I certainly, you know, talked it up to everyone, and I was kind of surprised when in our circle there was a lot of disinterest. There's been sort of disinterest in the comic and disinterest in the film.
I think some of our friends who were in the comics world had met Brian Lee O'Malley a bunch of times, and maybe their personal relationship with him interfered a little bit. But anyway, that aside, like, yeah, people just weren't, like, our friends who saw it all generally really liked it. But I worry, like, whenever I really like a movie or something, I want to go and talk it up. But then I feel like sometimes I end up having this reverse effect where then people are like, oh, I've been hearing good things about whatever. And then when they see it, they have their expectations are so high that nothing can live up to them. And they're like, oh, that was...
The third wave of people who saw Napoleon Dynamite were not terribly impressed.
No, they were all really disappointed. They were like, what was the buzz? And I think part of it was because it was so unexpected. Like, the example I always go to is Juno, because we saw like a free screening or something. And I didn't...
No, we didn't.
It wasn't free?
Nope.
We saw it like opening weekend or something for some reason.
That's true.
And I don't know... I don't remember why. Like, if someone had told me the pitch, I'm not really sure if I'd want to see it. Maybe our friends were seeing it. But we knew the Moldy Peaches were in it.
Yeah,
the soundtrack.
That was what sold me on it. Of course, you do recall that...
You'd read the screenplay.
I read the screenplay because your friend had forwarded us the screenplays that he was working on in the development house that he worked for.
And you were like... I thought you didn't think this... Was that one of the ones that wasn't very good? Or?
I thought it was terrible.
Oh.
I thought it was terrible and unmarketable. I thought that it was a screenplay that had been written by some 38-year-old neckbeard who was in love with the protagonist.
Then it turned out it was written by a working-class waitress.
And she won the Academy Award for screenwriting for it.
By the time we saw the movie, though, the script was vastly different than the one that you read?
It was
the same.
The script was identical. It had not been changed, I don't believe, in the slightest.
But you liked the movie.
Yeah, no, I liked the movie a lot.
Me too.
And
do you think it was like something the director brought to it?
It's tough to say. It was done with a lot more heart than I had read in the screenplay, because I thought that the snappy dialogue, just like how I feel like in Buffy frequently, the sitcom zingers really deducts from the drama.
Yeah.
And I felt like it was played well. It's another sort of hipster-esque comedy that has a lot of feeling. And I remember, and God help me, I mean, when I told this to our friends, they thought that I was, a horribly creepy pervert.
Oh.
But she, in the screenplay, and even in the movie a little bit, her chemistry with the guy who got her pregnant is not that great.
No, it's not.
He's kind of a zero.
Michael Cera.
And her chemistry with the guy who's going to be the adoptive father is really good. Reading in the screenplay, of course, I wasn't actually picturing a creepy old guy, which is what that actor, Jason...
Is he the guy from Sliders?
No, he's not the guy from... You're thinking of Jerry O'Connell.
I am.
This was...
The guy who looks like...
The guy who was on Arrested Development.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Jason Bateman, is that right?
Maybe. But yeah, they do... Like, they are able to talk, in a non-awkward way.
So it seems super weird in the movie.
Yeah.
That here's this married 30-something guy who's going through a midlife crisis, and he starts hitting on a 17-year-old pregnant girl.
Yeah, it's pretty gross.
Like, I can kind of appreciate that. Reading the screenplay, it seemed very clear to me that the guy's wife was the problem.
Yeah.
That she was holding him back.
Oh. When you watch the movie, I don't think you...
Well, I still... Her character still kind of bugs me.
Yeah.
But that's probably less because of the narrative and more because of my own hang-ups about child rearing and so forth.
Because in the movie, it's really clear, like, he has this fantasy that he can stay young and cool if he doesn't, like, have a kid.
Right.
But he's already like this established commercial music writing guy who's no longer young, and he's not cool.
Right. And how does that make him different from us?
Trying to hang on and being young and cool. Mm. I don't know. Oh, because but you're not hitting on a 17-year-old.
No, right? That's true.
Right.
No.
And that's the main thing.
I'm not.
Also, I think you and I are on the same level when it comes to approaching child rearing.
Well, that's
I am not like gung ho, and you're not like, oh no, or whatever.
Right.
So we're both equally
we're also both, you know, we share the same interests, and
yeah,
that's why we're doing this podcast,
right?
That's why I married you.
Not saying we listen to all the same bands or anything,
my love.
But yeah,
no, that's true.
Anyway,
but I felt like what came through in the screenplay was that that relationship was actually the most vital, meaning it had the most vitality to it.
Wait, whose relationship?
In the relationship between the adoptive father and Juno.
Mm.
Clearly, I mean, I was totally off base on the whole thing.
Yeah,
I would have.
I mean, I was so surprised by the film that I went and told my coworkers. I was like, "Oh, it was good," and blah blah blah. And when they saw it, they were like, "I don't see what the big deal was," because they'd also heard it was good from a bunch of places and it won that award. But by the time they heard it was good, it had tainted their expectations. This is something I brought up in the forums a little bit. I think when I sat down to see
Scott, talk about the ANN forums,
yeah,
right? Yeah.
When I sat down to see Scott Pilgrim on opening weekend with our friend, and we showed up really early because we were worried it would sell out. I think it was a packed house. I don't know if it sold out completely.
We did see it. But if it wasn't opening weekend, it was very early.
Yeah,
in the
it
run.
Was pretty early. We didn't see it like midnight opening. We saw it like Friday night. And there was a really big line of people and things, and it was a really good crowd that we saw it with. And I think that can make a big difference. If you see a really funny movie with a silent audience in the theater, it is bad news. It can be death. Because I saw Rushmore twice, once on a college campus screening where Jason Schwartzman was there, and like it was before it was showing in the theaters, but there was a lot of buzz about it. And then like they packed, you know, the free movie thing full and people were wild about the film. I saw Rushmore again later with my friend when it was like in its 12th week of release in the afternoon in a theater out in the middle of nowhere. And like two people laughed. My friend didn't like it. Like there was like two other people. My friend didn't like it. I was like, "You're not my friend." Like, I did not actually say that. But there was another incident where we theater hopped to a much worse movie and she was like, "That was a good movie." And I'm like, "You're not my friend."
Yeah. Well,
anyway.
Yeah.
I'm still friends with her despite that.
There's no accounting
for some
taste.
Reason.
For instance, someone made Sekire a rental shelf, but we won't even go
into
that.
I know, right?
That.
It wasn't offensive enough. You know what? Okay, so here's the other thing. So Clarissa and Gerald saw the new Tron Legacy movie, and they both really liked it. But Gerald doesn't like Summer Wars, and he didn't like Scott Pilgrim, so I don't know if he can be trusted. He has anti-taste.
Hmm. Well, I didn't like Summer Wars all that much.
I liked Summer Wars.
I know
a lot.
You did, man. I know.
I loved it. I mean, we can also reverse our list of favorite Satoshi Kon movies. Like, I like them in the reverse order that you like
them.
Yeah,
that's
much.
True.
In any case, because I went in, I was a little worried about the Scott Pilgrim movie because I'd seen an early trailer where I didn't like the video game effects. Like, it seemed like there were a lot of, like, words jumping out in a comic book way, like bong or whatever, and thwack, and it just looked really bad. And so I was totally extremely worried. And like Zach saw it from ANN, saw like a preview screening and was saying how great it was. And usually he's not way off on things, although Escaflowne is one of his favorite shows ever. They did another top 10 list and he was talking about how tightly written it was. I'd argue that Fortune, yeah, I could. You weren't there to listen to that show, but...
Wow, too bad.
I had a...
Well, I mean, too bad I wasn't on that show.
I had a picture of Noah and...
We've just been a wall of sound.
I had a picture of Noah, like, rolling his eyes in his... So I was, like, cautiously optimistic about the film, but it really blew my expectations out of the water, so I wasn't really expecting it to be all that great, and that's why I wasn't, like, too let down by the ending, either, because I'd also read the comic ending in advance, so I already had this alternate ending in my head. For me, it was a pleasant surprise that the movie was so good and that I liked it so much. For my friends who I then turn around and say, "Oh my God, this movie was so good and I liked it so much," and then they see it, like Alan of The Reverse Thieves was like, "That movie was okay, but I don't see why people are like fanatically crazy about it." For me, like, I think when I heard the film wasn't doing well after I liked it so much, I wanted to see it again, and I couldn't really get together a group of friends who hadn't seen it who wanted to because nobody wanted to see it.
To our surprise.
Yeah. Then I was so frustrated that, like, then I became a proponent of the film, like, more so.
Yeah, you
like,
become a zealot.
Yeah, then I become a zealot. And then people start to think I'm crazy. Then, like, I have the crazy eye. They're like, "Don't listen to her. She's, like, one of those crazy Scott Pilgrim fans." You know? And then I can't be trusted at all. Like, it works in this horrible kind of wheel of detriment.
Right. I was concerned about the film, or I went in with low expectations because I thought Michael Cera was miscast. I also saw a trailer where the video game effects didn't look right to me.
Yeah, they didn't look like they were keeping with the book.
Because they shouldn't be too slick. You know, they shouldn't look too slick.
It should have been like 8-bit.
I wish we could talk about the end of that film. because the way it ends made me feel, at least, kind of like shaking my head and saying they didn't learn anything at all. Not they, the characters, but they, the screenwriter and the director. You know, they didn't understand what their movie was about. They didn't get it. Because Brian Lee O'Malley, in the comic, he gets it. He understands.
Right.
And the way that it ends is completely appropriate and moving. Mm-hmm. You know, it's beautiful and heartwarming.
Right.
And I mean that in a non-ironic sense.
Yeah.
I mean, it was really, you feel very deeply for the characters who have overcome these incredible odds to be together. And that's the way it should be.
I think the thing with the big ship and all that stuff, that was a little weird. I don't know.
Big ship?
Yeah, like he has women in like suspended animation.
Oh, you're
yeah.
talking about
the end of the comic.
Yeah. What's his face?
Yeah, the bad guy.
The evilest ex of them all.
Yeah. I thought it was a little weird. That seemed kind of left field to me. Like, I thought some of the explanations made sense, but... I do like the abstract ending where it's a bunch of pages of Scott and Ramona in like their what weird interdimensional white space, which is used in the comic a lot and less so in the movie.
Right. Well, that's warp space. That's
right.
Just like in Mario, right?
Yeah.
You go through the warp.
That's true.
Or subspace, I guess they call it.
Yeah, they keep calling it subspace.
Which is what that, you know, represents is sort of the weird heart and mind space.
It's like when Shinji disappears into the Eva and you see what's going
yeah.
on.
Yeah.
And he's riding the train and everyone's heads are really huge and he's all fisheye. It's that kind of space.
A good, it's the non-tangible sort of, it's not spiritual because of the connotations that go along with spiritual.
Yeah.
But it is somehow sort of the mushy gestalt.
The psychic space.
Yeah. That people occupy emotionally.
Mm. Okay, I want to mention how something about the look of the comic and the way it was released. It comes out in like paperback graphic novels that are about the same size as manga from Oni Press, and it's in black and white. All the characters have really big eyes, but they're not kind of anime eyes because they don't have the same reflections. It's like one big black pupil. Because I realized at the second screening I went to, a lot of people had seen the movie. Almost nobody in the audience had read the comic.
Hmm.
And like Hal kind of said the same thing too about working in the comic book store, that like they had a movie that was, I mean, they had posters that were like, you've seen the movie, now read the book. And there were a lot of people in the store at least one person was like, that's based on a book? Like, not realizing, because distribution of movies is everywhere, but comics especially.
Right.
I showed the comics to my Japanese teacher, and he was like, oh, this is manga. And I was like, nope, it's Canadian.
Right, and it's, the paneling is manga.
It's manga-like, yeah.
Or reminiscent of manga.
Right, without being overly so. It's not like Tokyo Pop's Rising Stars of Manga kind of... We threw some screen tone in there and call it a manga. It's not trying to be manga.
No,
it's
certainly he is a manga fan.
Yeah.
And, you know, in every interview that he's ever done, he's always asked, you know, what his manga inspirations were, or, you know, where what he was keeping in his mind when he was actually writing it. And as I recall, although it's easy enough to look up any one of those interviews, he really didn't consider any manga when he was doing it.
Yeah.
Certainly manga that he likes, but there wasn't anything that he was channeling,
right.
I guess.
He just kind of effortlessly drew something that uses the sort of manga grammar of comics.
Well, I wouldn't say that it was effortless.
When
you listen to him talk about
how hard it is.
Yeah, painstaking process of doing all this stuff, and how his hands halfway through the run, he was at the middle of volume 4 or something.
Yeah.
And his hands were like arthritic. They were like carpal tunneled in such a way that it was really difficult for him to make his deadline. In fact, I don't think he did. I think that he blew through his deadlines on the fourth and fifth book. The sixth one came out on time, though.
And he got help too, like he had assistance
by the sixth
one.
Yes, at the end he did get some assistance.
Compared to the pace that manga is produced at, he seems ridiculous because he was
ridiculously slow.
Yeah, ridiculously slow. Yeah. And then I was following his blog or whatever for a really long time, and there were just like a lot of complaints, like, guys, you know how hard this is. Yeah. Like, he really had a rough time of it, but I think that's kind of lost on the average sort of, I don't think we realize how fast regular manga artists produce with assistance or not.
Well, yet. I certainly didn't until Ed showed us that schedule where your average mangaka, firstly, your
that's
average a,
that's
mangaka.
That's weekly. That's for weekly.
That's for weeklies, yes.
And that guy had assistants.
But
it's like monthly people don't have assistants as much.
Right. And they don't always have assistants. The weeklies
right.
don't always have
right.
assistants.
Right, it's only the
assistants
come in like
well
3 days a week. And yeah.
But 2 hours a week, man. I mean, every minute of your entire week,
yeah.
except for those 2 hours, are scheduled. And you have to keep to that schedule.
That image has been making the rounds on Tumblr and mm-hmm. on some comics mm-hmm. blogs, but without linking back to our podcast or like the origin of where I list like the book it's from. It showed up on some comic page and Ed had to pipe into the comments and be like, oh, Aaron laid that out like with the code.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But from a book he provided. So he gave like the book that it's from.
Oh, okay. I don't. Yeah, yes. It,
anyway,
clearly,
so that's
it
like
should
a,
be, it should be sourced, but I'm perfectly happy that that's making the rounds at all.
Yeah, me
I
too.
Think that that's something that people should know.
Yeah. Oh, it came up because I have a Google alert for my name. And because Ed
right.
mentioned my name in the comics.
Right.
In the comments of that post.
But if anything, I think the style of Scott Pilgrim, the graphic novel, it has a video game look.
Oh, yeah?
Not yet. The proportions are out of River City Ransom. And so when Brian Lee O'Malley actually got to make a video game out of his series, that's what he made it look like, was River City Ransom.
That's what Dave played it and said it was too much River City Ransom.
Yeah, I think I haven't played it, but I watched some levels
yeah.
on YouTube. And
I never played River City Ransom, so would I not think it was would I not get the nostalgia aspect? Or?
Probably not.
Probably not. Anyway.
But I think it's clearly informed by that style.
Mm. Maybe that's all I wanted to say about it.
Yeah.
I guess I have some fun facts about the movie. The movie was storyboarded in a really super detailed way because part of it was being written during the writer's strike where they had a lot of time to do stuff. And so they had a storyboard artist who helped out with the sixth book who drew exactly in Brian Lee O'Malley's style, like a very precise storyboard for every tiny thing. Because every tiny moment of the film was totally pre-planned in advance with not much room for improvising stuff at all. So every moment was taken care of, every joke. And then they shot it sequentially without a lot of... because sometimes the way they'll shoot a Hollywood movie is like do one wide shot and like shoot the whole scene that way and then go in for close-ups and things. For Scott Pilgrim, they didn't. They would go shot for shot exactly the way it was in the storyboard and shot the movie in chronological order as well. And so that's kind of a weird way to
shoot. Yeah, it's very rare.
And the production was kind of like jarring for the director who was used to making like these low budget movies. Like, was Shaun of the Dead couldn't have been that low budget.
No, I think it certainly by comparison to what he got for Scott Pilgrim, which I believe was $100 million that movie cost and grossed $20 million.
Well, maybe it'll make it up in the overseas. Nope.
Yeah, probably not.
Our,
I don't know.
The
what
sales?
A huge disappointment.
But he was used to working on a much smaller scale, so he was kind of like terrified at different parts of the production where they're like, we built these rigs that are going to, these platforms that'll lower up and down and all this stuff. And he's like, what? Like, just freaked out. He also talked about how he's in a weird position where Universal contracted him to direct the movie, but then he had to continually sell the movie back to them. Like, even though they'd given them this contract, he was continually in positions where they were like, tell us why we should still be interested in this, making this film. And he had to keep pitching it back to them, even though they were the ones that put the comic in his lap in the first place.
Right.
He also went beyond above the studio's head or something. Like, they handed him the comic and made him this offer, and then he called Brian Lee O'Malley and was like, is it cool with you if I do this or whatever? And they had a chat and then he was like, okay. And once he got Brian Lee O'Malley's okay, then he's like, okay,
ahead.
I'll direct it. I'm glad he did that. I like his other films. I like Hot Fuzz. He's hilarious.
Oh, which I haven't seen.
Good movie.
I believe it. I've heard it's funny.
But again, that movie has a thematic similarity because it's about some guys who have watched way too many, like, bad American action movies. Like, there's a character in that film who's, like, really obsessed with Point Break. And so there are many scenes in the film that, like, spoof big American action films. And at the end, they do a, like, a shot-for-shot kind of parody of the Point Break ending with people jumping a fence and this thing happening. And even though I've seen the end of Point Break on cable, I've never watched the whole thing. And
Via con Dios.
Right. Like, the fat cop character says that. And it's fun times.
Yeah, I believe it.
And so the other fun trivia that I don't know if I recorded in my iPhone recording was that, so the opening of the film kind of opens and Scott introduces the band to his new girlfriend Knives, and they start playing a song, and then it kind of smash cuts to the opening credit sequence, which is a scratch and doodle animation that was done at the last minute because after a few test runs and test screenings, the director sent a copy of the film to Quentin Tarantino, who watched it and then called and was like, it's really great and I really like it. But, you know, I think it needs some more space between that opening set of jokes and then, you know, the rest of the movie. Like, you need to have an opening credit sequence or something so we can, like, just absorb, like, this is the world of the film and where it goes from there. And so the director was like, you're right. And, like, had this scratch noodle thing made, like, not that long before the film's release. Mm-hmm. And it works really well. Like, when I watched it after hearing that, I'm like, it's true. Like, that's a really good moment to let it settle in. Also, the band, you're never supposed to know in the film if Sex Bob-omb is great or horrible.
Yeah.
Like, and
they could be either really good or really bad.
Right.
It's not clear.
That's not clear in the comic. And the way the band comes off in the film, you're still not clear. Like, that's the exact direction that they gave. They had Beck do the music, and they told him that as the direction. Like, you're playing this character of this band, and you need to know, like, we're not supposed to be sure if they're good or bad. And so he wrote these songs in character and kind of like a test track that he sent them. It was like, okay, do you want me to clean it up? And they're like, this test track is great, and we're using it as is because it's hilarious. I think also the opening, the very first shot in the movie, which is a Universal Pictures logo rendered in 8-bit with a fun 8-bit Universal Studios, like, intro, you know, do 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 do,
in like MIDI.
Do do do. That was done by, I don't know, like the director's brother or something, kind of as a joke for one of the screenings, and he put it together really fast, and it went over so well at the first one. They were just like, we're not even going to change it at all. We're just going to, like, as is. It's awesome.
Well, it is. It is.
It is really, really funny.
It's a very good idea.
It's almost as funny as the opening where, like, when they did the Mystery Science Theater, the movie that had a theatrical run, like, they have the opening of the film within
Silent
the film.
Silent Earth?
I guess so.
That's the movie, the MST3K movie.
Right, where they have the same kind of like Universal Pictures opening, but it's a model of the Earth because the movie they're watching is like so old. And they make some joke about it's like perfect weather on Earth. There's like no clouds at all. Even like Ebert or someone was like, that is hilarious. Like, that's a good joke right from the start. Those are most of the film trivia things that I know, except for like the second ending that they shot. The cinematographer, the reason they were at NYU doing a talk is because the cinematographer went to NYU like in the 70s, and he's gone on to be cinematographer on a bunch of stuff, including like, I don't know, Spider-Man 3 or whatever, and like a bunch of really big kind of Hollywood films. He was a really quiet kind of guy, but had some interesting insight on what a director brings to a film. He was saying like 98% of a movie or 90% of a movie, it's like all behind the scenes stuff and like crew things and stuff the audience never thinks about or is aware of. What the director brings is like that top 10%, very tip of the pyramid, and that can make make or break the whole thing, and that's what makes it memorable with audiences or not. Audiences aren't really aware of the giant crews and all the things that go into
the
mechanics and the craft.
Everyone works very hard for that to be the case. It should be seamless.
Yeah.
Or most directors believe that it should be seamless.
Yeah. But you need someone to bring that extra, like, human warmth in the top, you know, someone who has that vision of the whole thing. The other thing they did in the production, if you're interested in film making, is that that they said was really helpful. They shot a 1-minute test where they took a fight sequence and shot it the way they hoped the movie would look in the end. And that was the most useful thing they did, because then every time a new person came on as a crew member or an actor, they had the 1-minute test they could show to see, to tell them, like, this is how the film's going to look. This is how these fights are going to pan out. And everyone who watched it would be like, oh, now then they understood perfectly, having seen that footage, then they could move forward. And it was also really useful for, like, showing the studio and fundraising and stuff like that. Like, or if, again, keeping Universal interested in the project, they would, oh, you haven't heard of it, you haven't read the comic, even though you gave it to me, here's this 1-minute thing, and now you understand. Now you understand what the movie's about and what it's going to look like and why it's good.
Hollywood, it's big, studio, big system.
Big company.
Ridiculous. I guess I have two things to say about Brian Lee O'Malley. The first is that in the little 3-minute clip that we have from 2007 at MoCA, I talk about a Comics Journal article on his, I guess it was the third book or the fourth book.
I don't remember. We'll put a link up to it.
That was a pan. It was, I don't read Comics Journal, you know, that often unless it's something that happens to, you know, interest me. But I was, it was kind of a for how popular it was at the time.
Yeah.
It was a very negative review. That comes apparent, I think, pretty quickly in the interview, but that's what I'm talking about when I ask him if he had read it or not.
We keep talking about how popular the comic is, but one thing that came up during the panel that they'd had was that the first book, when it came out, only sold like 160 copies early on. And knowing like how small print runs and small publishers are go, like I could see if you did a print run of like 300 copies and, you know, only 160 or something sold, that seems like these tiny numbers. But eventually it did take off. Like it keeps going back to get for more print runs.
Right.
Like it sold. When we talk with Brian Lee O'Malley, we'd say how quickly it sold out the previous year at the con. And it's always like a perennial, like well-stocked at my local, at the local comic book store and bookstores.
Mm-hmm.
They try and keep all
and
five
when,
or six.
When we talk about popularity in this instance, we're not talking about mainstream popularity, clearly. We're talking about indie comics popularity.
Right.
Which is a much, much smaller
scale.
It's a tiny
pool.
Yeah, it's a tiny pool, but it was, and I guess is still to a certain extent,
yeah,
extremely popular in that pool.
Yeah, because people, having seen the movie, want to go back and read it if they haven't.
Right.
That kind of thing.
The second thing is that there was an interview with O'Malley, I believe it was again in the Comics Journal, but that might not be true.
The one in Giant Robot magazine?
Maybe it was Giant Robot. It was a really relatively long article.
Oh, okay.
I feel like I was reading it at work, so I don't think
it wasn't
a print article. But one of the things that I was struck with, he talked about the writing process and how he does it, but he says that one of the things that he really enjoys doing is misleading the reader. It's something that he really, like, the most fun that he has in doing things is messing with people's anticipation. And I found that very interesting because, you know, I'm not a writer. When I was trying to be, that was something that I had a lot of trouble with. It's true, a good writer or a good storyteller has to reverse the expectations of the reader, you know, mm-hmm. of the viewer, the listener, whatever.
Yeah.
And I find that I have a really hard time with that because it feels dishonest. There's something that seems jerky.
No, writers are liars.
That's right. Well, that's why I'm not, perhaps. But that in particular is what he enjoys about the process. I think that's very telling when you read the graphic novels and the way that it plays out. I think that comes through really clearly.
Huh.
And a lot of the better moments, I think, are those instances where your expectations are totally reversed.
Hmm.
Particularly in the last book.
I don't know. Because I read the comic like slowly, as I think in the first couple volumes I may have read back to back. Maybe not. Maybe I read it one volume at a slow time. But because there are so many characters between comics, I tended to forget who all of them were, which is not very helpful. So I was like just surprised in the last one. I'm like, oh, so-and-so turned out to be gay.
Spoilers.
Why was Julie such a jerk?
We won't tell you who. We won't tell you who.
Obviously the film being the running time it is, that was never a confusing thing. Why was Scott's sister a jerk? I don't even remember her being in the comic that much. In the movie, she's so, like, annoying. Like, I don't know.
Well, she is around.
Yeah, she's around.
She serves the same function.
Yeah.
She's kind of a more grounded voice.
She just seems continually outraged by his behavior.
Well, his behavior is outrageous.
It's warranted, but she also seems like a gossip in that way.
Well, she's his sibling. What do you expect?
It's true. I don't gossip about my sibling. Maybe. I'm not continually, like, outraged or shocked by my brother's behavior. I mean, I did grow up with him, after all.
Right.
Anyway, it's a good time. Totally recommend this movie and the books.
Yeah, I think if people have made it this far, they got that.
Yeah, pretty much. Like, one of our friends didn't know anything about it and saw it and was like, hey, that was really good. He's like, I thought it was going to be about bands or something. I mean, it is, but it isn't. Like, that's not the most important. There are several Battle of the Bands. That's not the most important thing about the movie.
Right.
But that's our defensive Scott. Oh, I read one website that had it was saying, like, the reasons why this film didn't do well, and it was going into how people under 30 don't understand this film. And I think the point of that paragraph was, like, if you're too young, you wouldn't really understand the movie because you wouldn't have gone through enough relationships to know what they're talking about.
Right.
But if you're too old, you won't understand the movie because old people didn't play video games growing up. So it was saying only people who were exactly 30 would get the movie, which is it was saying, like, nerds play video games, right? And this should be a movie that nerds should enjoy. But a lot of nerds are virgins who have never been in any relationships. So to them, it seems...
They're going
to
be resentful.
Right. To them, it seems really unrealistic. Why are these women just throwing themselves at Scott Pilgrim? Like, it seems like... And why is he so ungrateful that women, like, seem to enjoy his company? Or, like, that nerds haven't been in bands, that the crossover demographic of people who, like, are cool kids playing in bands are not the same as nerdy kids playing video games. But I think lately everyone plays video games. It's now mainstream enough.
Yeah, it's now pretty much mainstream.
Yeah, everyone grew up playing video games. It's not really that kind of thing. Or in one part of some A&N cast, was it Justin or someone was saying how could his parents understand this movie? Because at one point, like, Ramona pulls a giant hammer out of her very small purse, and that is, in fact, using a term nerds would call hammer space, like where the hammer is being stored. I think it's taken from City Hunter. There's hammer space, which is like an interdimensional pocket that
this isn't
for
this
comedy.
This isn't literal.
Right.
I mean, in the film, it's literal because her bag goes into subspace.
Right.
But hammer space is, if you have ever seen City Hunter, the protagonist's female counterpart is he's very lecherous and kind of like in Lum. Every time Ataru gets lecherous, Lum zaps him. So in City Hunter, she just hits him with a 20-ton hammer.
Which she pulls out of nowhere. Maybe her purse, which is tiny. Yeah, that kind of thing. So there's hammer space in the film, and the sort of debate was much older people would not understand hammer space at all. Like, the physics of the film would just seem like, what the hell is going on? I do approve of, like, at Comic-Con, I've seen some good... And at other anime cons, I've seen some good Scott Pilgrim cosplay.
Oh, yeah, lots of good Scott Pilgrim cosplay.
I think it's kind of a sleeper movie. Like, people rent it a lot. That they were, like, people were unconvinced.
Well, in order to be a sleeper, it would have had to have done better, so...
I know. That was the point I wanted to bring up.
Good.
Just because the movie failed at the box office, but it was a good movie, doesn't mean the film was a total failure. I don't think it's ruined that director's career of directing. Like, maybe he won't make another Universal picture, but he was an indie director to begin with.
Right.
So maybe
it hasn't ruined his career, but that's only because he is a small-time, well, not small-time, but small-budget overseas director, primarily.
But why?
I think it will cap Michael Cera's career.
I don't know. I think he can come back.
That's my prediction.
I'm just saying, the film failed at the box office, but is it because that we're Americans or because we were film majors that we're so obsessed with, like, oh, it's too bad that film didn't do well. In the larger context of, like, lay people and stuff, like, who aren't obsessed with pop culture entertainment, like, the film is a success if it was a good movie. Like, Miracle on, and if it touches people who really like it, like, just because the ticket sales weren't great when it had a theatrical run. Like, a lot of, there are several movies that are really great examples that have really had, like, a lasting impact. Like, Miracle on 34th Street was legendarily released during the summer. It was a failure at the box office. And, like, a three-week
That's
run.
That's pretty funny. I didn't know that, actually.
And people remember it forever. Like, it's a film that endures, in part because it's a holiday movie, but also, like, it's not a bad movie. It just had, like, a unfortunate set of circumstances surrounding it.
Well, the reason...
History doesn't remember.
Certainly, the film, the film as a film was not a failure. It's excellent, right? But the film as a representation of the genre is a failure because when things do really well,
yeah.
It sends signals in the marketplace. More like this, please.
Right.
And
if
this
it's a good movie that did badly, so we're sending a signal. No more good movies, please.
Yeah. So
but more,
I feel
more like Avatar. James Cameron's Avatar.
Right.
Because that's like the highest grossing film like ever
yeah,
or something.
Yeah. So we're going to get
more spectacle.
More like that. And well, there's a fair amount of spectacle in Scott Pilgrim.
Oh, yeah.
But it didn't resonate.
Right.
So on that count, I think, and that's what's very painful for me.
But maybe it resonated with people who saw it, but so many people didn't see it that it didn't really have a chance.
Well, yes, by definition. It's upsetting because so many things that I, dare I say, just like Cameron's Avatar, you know, are offensive to my being.
Right.
That hurt the soul of my soul.
Your soul's soul.
That stuff is what makes billions. And something like this, which I find, you know, very deeply personal and meaningful,
yeah.
fails to find an audience. Mm. It's infuriating.
Maybe it just shouldn't have had such a big budget to begin with.
I don't know. Could you do a movie that was so effects intensive with half that? But even if
we're
talking about in order to have turned a profit,
right.
It would have needed 1/5 the budget. I don't think you could make that movie on 1/5 the budget.
Visual effects people put themselves out of business all the time making.
Well, only during the writer's strike could you have made that movie.
No.
I mean, yes, they put themselves out of business all the time,
yeah.
But only during, like, Moon, that sci-fi film.
Oh.
The only reason why Moon was able to be made was they were sitting on their duffs.
I thought someone like David Bowie, someone's relation was involved.
David Bowie's son, I believe, directed the movie.
Yeah.
And that didn't hurt, but it was made for a very tiny budget.
Right.
And the only reason why they could do that and not a budget that was probably 10 times what it was, is that there was zero. There was no work for all these special effects people.
Oh.
So they were willing to take it on.
Oh, I see. But I read another thing. Like, I'm saying this based on, like, that 3D class
right, yes.
that I took over the summer, where there was an article, and this guy wrote this, like, open letter to James Cameron saying, like, how rough it is in the visual effects house world in Hollywood, where famously in some article in Variety or something, a producer was quoted as saying, if he doesn't put a visual effects studio out of business when he makes a movie, he hasn't done his job.
Right.
Because visual effects studios, like, it used to be there weren't that many of them, and visual effects were really expensive, any kind of digital editing was really expensive. Now it's really cheap, and everyone does visual effects all the time.
Yep.
And so there are so many visual effects studios that they'll undercut each other to get a deal with a movie,
yep.
and then put themselves out of business by the time the movie's over.
And that is the market telling video effects people,
do something else.
Do something else.
With
and
your life.
It's a harsh reality, but that is the truth.
Right. Because everyone wants the fun job of working on movies.
Yep.
So it doesn't pay anything. Anyway, that's depressing. But I'm saying the other way. Like, just because a film failed in the box office, didn't make its money back, and may have ruined a couple careers, doesn't mean it's a bad movie and that you should give shits. Oh, and the other thing I was saying on the forums was something that... I had a theater teacher at community college who was like the head of the department, and he said some of the best times he saw plays were he had a friend who would take him to see plays like almost like blindfolded. Like, he wouldn't let him know the title of the play, anything about what it was about, nothing about who was in it. So when when the curtain went up, it was like magical because just anything could happen on the stage, which is true in theater. Like, you can get away with like a lot of anything could happen. You could do a whole play with just, you know, a chair for a prop, and it could take place in some crazy fantastical universe, or
sure.
it could be Shakespeare and whatever. Theater is very free like that. So because he would go in with like absolute zero expectations at all. It was like an amazing adventure to watch things. And you can't really do that with movies, like where the way that they're marketed. I mean, I think the experience I've had with that is like sometimes I've watched movies on TV where I don't know anything about it. Maybe I read the one line description on cable. Maybe not. Maybe it just started. It's just the next thing playing on Sundance Channel. And I'm just like from the opening credits, like don't know what this is going to be about. Don't know what's going to happen. Don't know the title unless they show the title. And like that's the only real way to get like this kind of zero level going in.
Right.
But the more we talk about Scott Pilgrim, the more people have like a bunch of expectations going in.
Well, I...
But I feel like I'm also like damning myself as a paid reviewer when I say like don't read any reviews. I don't.
Well, I don't. But
don't
then
watch trailers.
People very rarely, although I'm kind of surprised by the people on the forum who say, you know, oh, I wasn't going to check this out, but after reading your review, I think I will.
Yeah.
Because it certainly seemed to me that the only people who read reviews are people who are, looking to see what other people think about what they have already seen, which is weird to me.
Right. But I have gotten a lot more forum comments now that are more people like, I think now that the raging controversy has died down about the way I review things and what I like and not. Now people pipe in and are like, oh, I'm going to move this up on my queue because I've heard several people recommend it, which is like displaying good traits because it means they've read several reviews other than mine or heard things about it elsewhere. They're not just depending on me as a sole source and that they're not necessarily going to, now I'm just going to buy this. It's more like I'm moving it further up on my to watch list before they make a buying decision.
Right.
I approve this behavior. I don't know, but I don't really do the same thing because I just have to watch everything. So in terms of anime, it seems like I had one other point I was going to make.
Yeah.
Before we wrap this up. It's based on a song called Scott Pilgrim.
That's where the title comes from.
That's where the title comes from, where the only lyrics are, I've loved you for 1,000 years. Or I've liked you for 1,000 years.
Yeah,
1,000 years.
You're going to hear that.
Yeah,
I'm clearly going to.
Yeah, clearly I'm going to include that. That's all. Merry Christmas, everyone.
Merry Christmas.
Hopefully I'll get this out for the holidays.
Maybe.
Maybe. This is Aaron. So the Shaun of the Dead, not Shaun of the Dead, the Edgar Wright recording that I did at NYU, it really didn't work out. I'm going to include like 3 minutes of the audio from the end of it so you can hear how bad it is. If anyone wants to volunteer to scrub through the audio I recorded and fix it or run some filters that you have that I don't, email me, ninjaconsultant@gmail.com. Otherwise, this is the end of the show. We'll see you next year.
So sometimes, I mean, I really love that kind of thought dialogue. And I remember when I was showing the bed in some scenes, some actors were doing wide shots, and you could sort of keep it like, you know, but keep it like they knew it was going to be edited later, and I could make it sort of slower later. But if you're doing like a feature of actors, the pause, you know, is there forever, and you can't, well, actually you can, but and sometimes the other way of getting around it is to put like a split screen in the shot and slip the sync so people like react quicker than they did on stage. I've done a couple of times. Mm-hmm. Usually though what's great is if there's really like sort of hard fast to hang out scene, the actors kind of like very quickly get into the books are not very violent in that they don't have some blood in or anything, so the books are kind of lying through naked. And so there's no question. Anything not so it was and And I think in a way, like, you know, we try to kind of make it more like a whole idea of making it like a musical that has a fight scene and a dance number. That was really the kind of beat of it. You play like, you know, sometimes you have songs, sometimes you have fights, and sometimes the songs are fights. That's the idea.
But some of the ones here you really are camera people. Okay, did you do a lot of just pin camera? Or did you do any, like, I mean,
the one, the bit at the end when Jason is going to suspend, and just, I'm not even sure if we had like the literally just put the standing by somebody like that,
uh-huh.
And then we had a head around his head. But then sometimes it's like a foot on a stick, like a shoe on a stick. Sometimes it's like a stuntman, like, yeah, because I, you know, like, every stuntman can stand there for hours, like, with their sneaker in his face. It's all shot on film, it's all shot on 35mm, except for some of the super, super slow-mo stuff. Which is kind of the Phantom with the 4x2000, I think. And the great thing with that is you can also watch it back immediately. So a lot of the goofy stuff is done on the Phantom. And it's really, you know, that's amazing cool. I mean, it's kind of replaced by the Sonic stuff. So it's really, you know, it's amazing. I mean, and I'm sort of kind of, I was a bit of a, you know, kind of digital technophobe. So the Phantom was like, it was amazing when there's something to watch back. Interesting, like, I don't know if you have this on your shooting, but like, because the slow-mo, you could watch it back in real time, everybody would always crowd around the monitor because there was like something to see that looked, you know, that was different than just normal feed. So it was amazing whenever there's a Phantom film, like everybody would crowd around the monitor. It was beautiful. It's like, you know, like, it's, we'll show the thing at the end with all the Phantom stuff at the end, but it's really, really interesting.
So, for little brother, most of us are brothers. So we try to build a very pleasant area so we can end up filming all the rest of the things. We have a big life. And he's just like, you know, he's really awesome. And he's just like, you know, he's talking about the industry. Are you really talking?